Okay, welcome everyone. Good afternoon. When I was preparing this talk, I was thinking of, I hold the talk in English because I know at least one in the audience is speaking English, so I hope that's fine. So I was preparing this talk and I was thinking, why should I present behavior-driven development on an architect conference? And Mario was telling me, no code, you shouldn't do too much code, you know, architects and so on. And I was like, oh shit, development in the title, oh, that's not good. And then, actually, as you will see, it's more about specifications and dealing with that and communication. And I was thinking, oh, that's also not for architects, it's too high level. So I was thinking, am I at the right conference with this talk? And actually, I think I am. So what I want to start with is why I think it could be interesting for architects, what I'm going to present in the next 1 hour and 10 minutes. Because architects are often dealing with things like domain-specific languages, UML diagrams, things like that, where they try to communicate between different stakeholders or solve the problem of communication between different stakeholders in delivering a project. And actually, this is what behavior-driven development is about, and this is what I want to show you in the next 1 hour. Something about me. I wouldn't consider myself as a real architect, so bear with me. I'm not coding anymore, and this is something which I think a real architect should do regularly. So I don't know how many of you are real architects in my eyes. But what I do is I deal with business a lot, I deal with projects a lot, I do coaching of teams who really have to deliver projects, and this is where I draw the content of this talk out. So what we have done in the last one and a half years in this area, and what is our experience in this area. I want also to know a little bit about the audience, so please raise your hands if any one of you is doing agile development. So who thinks he's doing agile development? Oh wow, okay, a lot of people. Who dares to say he uses waterfall? Okay, right? He has to use waterfall. I don't know. Anyone who says he's practicing test-driven development with his teams? Okay, a little bit less, good. Anyone who says he's doing acceptance test-driven development already, or who is already doing behavior-driven development? That's good, because the if it would be too many, then I would be worried about whether my talk is right targeted. And yeah, these are tools which I don't know. Anyone heard of any of these tools so far? Okay, so more than who are doing test-driven development, acceptance test-driven development, or BDD are actually having heard of these tools. Good. Great. So what do we want to present in the next hour? I want to quickly present why do we need another methodology or anything to improve? Do we need to improve at all? I guess the answer is, do we need to improve at all, is quite easy, but why do we need to improve? Second thing is I want to talk about what BDD is, the concept, how it works, what is the mindset about, and then I want to show you short demos about how this looks in practice, so that you also get not only a theoretical overview, but a little bit a grasp of how it really looks in practice, and some tips of what we found of trying to apply it in the last one and a half years when we are doing this already. So the first question, why at all? And the first question which I want to ask you, are we good in project delivery? Is everything working well? Are we good? Are you satisfied with how your projects run? Okay. It's always hard to somehow measure how good projects are delivered or how good you are in project delivery. But there is something which you probably know, the Standish Group, they are doing since many years a survey where they try to somehow measure whether projects are running well, not so well, or completely fail. And I don't want to discuss whether this is a good way of how they measure it or not. What I find interesting in this study is that they do the same methodology of measuring the project success since many years. So what is interesting for me is, how does the number of 2008 compare to the number of 2000? Any guess? Did it get better, worse? Better. Mm-hmm. Exactly, a little bit better. And if you look at the full graph, it's floating. So there, I wouldn't say there's a real trend towards up or down. It's, I don't know, probably already beyond the accuracy of this study. So although we have all these new tools, all these new methodologies, all these new practices, something is not really going well. So what's the problem? Martin Fowler, a famous architect, probably every one of you knows him, he's writing currently a new book about DSLs. And there is one statement which I found especially interesting in this book, which is that he thinks that the hardest thing to overcome in software development is the communication between the one who uses the software and the one who built the software. So communication is probably one of the sources why we cannot get better, because I don't see many inventions in the past 10 years which really significantly improve this communication. Another interesting study is something from James Martin. He made a study of where are errors introduced in software projects. And he did this in these categories: requirements, design, other, and code. So what are the sources of the error? At which point in the development of a project are these errors introduced? And any guesses what was the biggest area where errors were introduced? Yes, so you know that already. And this is basically what is the biggest resource where you can pull for improvement or where you can try to improve. So what are we doing to fight these errors? And what we see is that the traditional developers are mainly focusing on taking some specifications which they more or less take without questioning, or they maybe assume then something about it, but they don't try to test the specifications. They just take the specifications and try to somehow implement it. And if we find a way how we can improve this communication and this gathering of the requirements, make them testable, this is probably a way how we can make a leap forward in successfully delivering projects. And this is basically the idea why this methodology was invented and why this methodology is developed since some time already. So everyone already knows that gathering requirements is not so easy, and I don't know, probably every one of you has had similar situations like this here about trying to find out what to implement. I want to be a little bit more specific about problems which I see in gathering requirements nowadays. Many times we are much too abstract in how we do the requirement engineering. Many times we get much too detailed sometimes, so we get some solutions where we don't actually understand why this solution is needed. And what is even more hard or even causing more problems is that we have a lot of times changing between different abstractions of the requirements. So we have many different artifacts describing the requirements which are changed very often within the project. And these are, in my opinion, one of the biggest problems when we deal with requirement engineering in projects and when we try to find out what kind of system we actually have to build. Let's have a look at these problems a little bit in more detail. The first problem is, why do we have sometimes too abstract and sometimes too detailed requirements? And actually, if you look at requirements, you can categorize them, in my opinion, in three big categories. What you here see is basically the level of detail. Alistair Coburn describes the goal levels with this kind of pyramid or this kind of model. And the more you go up, the more you are abstract, the more you answer why certain thing requirement should be implemented or system should be implemented. And the more you go down, the more you describe how the implementation should look like. And what you see here is that basically the more you go into the how, the more big the requirements are, the more quantity of requirements you get, and the less predictable it is. And the three levels are the why level, which basically, you know, everyone knows that who has looked at requirements engineering so far, where you describe the vision, why the project is built, which is basically determining the project success. Second thing is specifications in different levels, where you basically say, what do I actually want to build? And this is what we mostly deal with when we get projects. And actually, the how, it's quite blank here. So very often what we build is directly from this code, or we have some loose assumptions here which are not helping us to build this because they are somehow made much too early, inconsistent, not logical, not understandable. So very often poor developers have to bridge, or development teams have to bridge this gap and basically take quite abstract descriptions and get down to the code and bridge this gap. On the other hand, what they present is very hard to understand for the people who wrote this. So this is the big gap between business and developers. So too abstract was the first thing which I said. What is the problem of having specifications only here? As you will see, or as you have seen probably, if you ask somebody to write formally down his requirements or to formally state his requirements, suddenly the people get very complicated in their expressions. So things are not really expressed clear. However, if you get into a conversation, what happens is you try to explain this by making examples, and explaining by examples suddenly makes you understand what is actually meant with a certain statement like this. So too abstract is the first big problem which we have. Even worse is we have these abstract descriptions here, and what architects then do often is, and other people on the project team, they build kind a lot of additional artifacts where they try to somehow design the system, make it more concrete what the system should actually do, doing UML diagrams, test cases, whatever you do. I have heard from companies where they told me, if the business wants to know finally what the system really is doing, we go to the testers and look into the test cases. And that's not a joke, and I can understand this to some extent. So still there are some developers, there were some design documents, so there are all kinds of different artifacts. The problem is that each of these artifacts is its own abstraction of the problem the business has. And during a project, we change a lot between these abstractions. And what kind of damage this can do, you can see with a nice game you can play by yourself. It's called the Broken Telephone Game. I don't know who knows that game. So it works in a way that you start off with a sticky note where you describe briefly some picture to describe, and then basically somebody has to draw this picture, so you change abstraction from text to picture. Then somebody has to describe again in text what the picture means, and then so forth, and you can come to very interesting conclusions. How funny this here is, this is often happening here in the same way, and this is what is causing a lot of problems in our specifications, and this is what we want to fight. Okay? So what everyone also have heard probably, that this leads to at least three silos, unless you don't have testers. Sometimes even more silos. So everyone builds his own world about trying to solve a problem business has, but these are separated from each other. And there's communication between these silos. I have a small clip which anyone knows this movie, Office Space? Okay, only a few, so I show it, because it's very short and it's very funny about how the communication
works. What you do in Inatech is you take the specifications from the customers and you bring them down to the software engineers.
Yes, that's right.
Well, then I just have to ask, why couldn't the customers just take them directly to the software people, huh?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because engineers are not good at dealing with customers.
So you physically take the specs from the customer?
Well, no. My secretary does that, or the fax.
So then you must physically bring them to the software people?
Well, no. Yeah, I mean, sometimes.
What would you say you do here?
Well, look, I already told you. I deal with the goddamn customers so the engineers don't have to. I have people skills. I am good at dealing with people. Can't you understand that? What the hell is wrong with you people?
Okay. So, I don't know whether communication between silos always works like that, but I think the point is made here. And how does this work in agile projects, this communication? So everyone knows the how we stream requirements from business goals down to user stories in agile projects. And then we have to build code. And there is the nice saying that the user story is a reminder for a discussion with the developers, where they know then finally what kind of code they have to build. So how does this discussion look like? Business comes with a new idea, user story. However, the developer thinks in his own silo. And the tester has its own abstraction of the problem. And this is basically making the problem of three different abstractions, descriptions of the problem we want to solve. How agile projects try to solve this in an ideal way is that these three people are in constant communication with each other. They're sitting together, they're sharing the same room, and they can immediately spot if they have any problems in understanding each other. However, in the reality, this is often doesn't work exactly like that, as you know. So customer is not always available, or product owner. Developer sits not in the same room like the tester. There is probably even strict role separation between these two, so they are probably not even allowed to talk with each other too much. So these are the typical problems which occur. And actually, there is what is happening then is that although we have this communication, we still have a communication gap here. And we get some descriptions about what we actually expect. And these descriptions are then usually formalized in bugs. Anyone has seen already when a system was specified or re-specified in Bug Tracker? I had this already. So we delivered, we thought we understood it, and then business came and entered 300 Bug Tracker entries. And it was very clear what they wanted afterwards. They were very concrete at this point. It was a lot of work for them. So the point is, can't we have these nice Bug Tracker entries a little bit earlier, just before we start to code? That's the point here. And there is actually something in agile specifications which is meant for that, which is called acceptance criteria. Anyone uses acceptance criteria? Okay, a few. This is the key here, which I want to elaborate further. So the point here is that acceptance criteria are mentioned for user stories, and I will shortly talk about what they are, to basically cover or guide the discussion between the team and the business to bridge this gap. However, there is usually the guideline how to do this acceptance criteria is not very well known, or many people don't know how to use this actually. And this is actually where behavior-driven development is hooking in. The goal is to have these acceptance criteria somehow formalized, concrete and consistent, in a way that they are traceable and really up to date, and not just some notes which you tear away and which are at the end of a sprint gone, and that you can expose and find them out just in time. This is the interesting part which we try to achieve. So the point here is that instead of acting in three different silos, that we actually go into a direction where all three stakeholders are talking in the same language and basically share a formalized set of acceptance criteria to describe the last set of details about how a user story or how a certain requirement should be implemented. As soon as they do this, they also will very quickly find hidden assumptions. So as soon as they speak in the same language, they will very easily and very quickly find new things which somebody assumed and others didn't know yet, where you then can say, yeah, we will support this, or no, this is too complicated to support. So actually, the point, as soon as you talk the same language, these hidden assumptions are much easier to be spotted and much easier to be discovered. So how does this work now? How can we stream these requirements down from user stories to acceptance criteria to code? So everyone knows the concept of user stories. Whether you use use cases or user stories, I don't want to go into this discussion now. I think user stories are very suitable to in such projects to describe isolated sets of features which you can deliver in an isolated way. However, the next thing is, once you are deciding that you want to implement such a user story, so you want to bridge this final gap here, the question is, how do you come to acceptance criteria? How we do this usually is that we ask the stakeholders, okay, this is the story we're going to build. I want to place books into my shopping basket. Dear user, imagine this feature is already implemented. A miracle happened. How would you now check that this feature is actually here? As soon as you start asking like this, the user will come up with several examples or several things which he will try out, and from that you can extract isolated acceptance criteria. Like, I will try to add a book into my shopping basket, obviously. I want to check that the basket is empty when I enter the store. I want to be able to remove a book from my basket. And probably another thing which you don't think of the first time is, when I add the same book twice into the basket, I expect that the quantity of the books in the basket is increased by one. This is, for example, already one acceptance criteria which is not to be assumed all automatically by a developer if you don't mention it. Because it could be also like that, that the system warns you about that you have this book already in your basket. So this is basically how you can break down one step further to bridge this gap into acceptance criteria. And this is actually how it's by the book. So if you read about acceptance criteria in general, this is what you will find there. However, I think this is still too abstract. So books can be added to the basket is still some, it's not really telling me what is meant by that. And bear with me, I know it's a very simple example, everyone knows what this is about, but this can be any complex logic or any complex aspect of logic. So what helps to make examples, abstract things better understandable? And what happens if you are discussing with business a certain statement like this and you don't understand what it means? Business will say at some point, I will give you an example, right? And what is happening is that as soon as somebody gives you a concrete example, you will start to understand what this means. However, these examples are usually just exchanged informally. So they are not formalized, they are not captured anywhere, they cannot be verified later on automatically. And this is the point where we try to hook in. So what we try to do is, we try to formalize examples so much that they are so formalized that they are almost indistinguishable from requirements, and that they are also very similar to tests. So this is a very key aspect of behavior-driven development, that when you break down your acceptance criteria, then you go one step further. You don't keep it abstract, but you bring up concrete examples which give you the idea of how the system should work. How can this look in practice? So like, this is the user story, I want to place books into my shopping basket. And the first acceptance criteria is that I can actually add a book into my basket. This is the first thing the story should deliver. Imagine I have an empty basket. If I place one book into the basket, then my basket should contain exactly this one book. This is a very simple example how I could explain you how this works, right? Another acceptance criteria, what we discussed previously, is adding the same book to the basket increases the quantity. I have already a basket with book one. If I add book one again into the basket, then my basket should contain exactly two books once. This would be explaining quite sufficiently how this should work, right? How are these examples structured? They have a part where we basically describe what are the preconditions that my user story can actually execute. What are the things that have to be given? What has to be the setup of the world that I actually can try out what I want to try out? The second part is the actual utilization of the feature I want to describe, where I expose exactly this aspect which I want to describe in this acceptance criteria. And the third part is a number of verifications which I want to do afterwards, after I have executed my feature, where I verify that the aspect which I want to describe with this example is fulfilled successfully or sufficiently. So far, so clear? You hear sometimes in about these three, so arrange, act, assert as AAA constraints, or testers also talk about checks. So they isolate features in such checks, so they really try to isolate each aspect of a feature like this. And this is what you do with the acceptance criteria as well. You can also chain up multiple of these steps. So you can have many preconditions or many assertions, or you could also have several things what you describing how you utilize the feature. So you can chain up steps like this. How do you come to this acceptance criteria? How does this process work? The first thing is the question which I already mentioned to you. So the first thing is, how would you try out this feature? And the business will start to tell you a lot of things. It will mix up different aspects about the user story, and you will have to identify each aspect separately. You will have to start with some abstract groups like you had before, like I can add items to a basket, I can remove them, and so on. You will sometimes even have different goal levels, so sometimes things are happening which are not directly visible to the user, like some logging aspects, some cross-cutting concerns, security could be described in this way. So there is not only what you directly see on the user interface, but other things that should be fulfilled by the system can be described by this. Then you can prioritize. What often happens in these discussions as well is that we realize that certain things the user assumes we don't want to fulfill because it will become too complex, it will become too much effort, and we want to basically upfront decide with the user that certain things should be shifted back and they should not have this supported by the system. This is much easier than saying to a bug report, this is a feature request and it costs a lot of money. And the third thing is what you have seen, that we finally break down the abstract examples into concrete examples. So we find this given when-then structure, we try to really come up with concrete data or concrete examples how this aspect can be described as an example. Sometimes what will happen is that people will tell you, I cannot give you an example. This is a good sign that the user doesn't really know yet what he needs. Or you're talking with the wrong person. That can also happen. So if somebody can tell you about a feature he has heard somewhere, somebody needs, but he cannot give you a concrete example, so he struggles with this step, the other thing could be this feature is needed, but the person you're talking to currently cannot tell you how this feature works, and it's not the person who needs the feature. It's also good to change then the one who you talk with. So now we have this formalized example. So we have broken down a system to something where we could bridge this gap. The next step is, how can we make this sustainable? How can we ensure that what we have defined isn't gone after we have delivered something? And this is where automation comes into the game. When you take the automation of your acceptance criteria and in Scrum projects or in HR projects your definition of done, you have something which is an executable specification, so something which can be automatically verified against the system. How does this work in the BDD tool I'm going to show you? You write the specification of your scenarios in plain text. These are feature files. So basically you describe all these examples in text files. Then for each of the steps you have seen, you bind these to an automation interface of your application. And then a test runner can execute these scenarios through this binding against your application. So these are the three steps how this works. I'm going to show you this with a tool which is called SpecFlow. It's an open source tool, so it's fully available for commercial usage without any restrictions. We did this basically because we were going into this domain and we wanted to use this kind of practice, and we realized that we saw a tool which is called Cucumber, which solves this quite well, but on the .NET platform it was very hard to run this tool. So we decided, after trying to run Cucumber, which is originating from, so it's built for Ruby, after playing around with Iron Ruby for some time on .NET and trying to do a project with that, we decided that actually the complexity of the tool is so low that it's easier to implement it than to struggle further around with that. And as I said, the actual idea of this way of automating acceptance criteria comes from a tool called Cucumber. It came up with these written specifications in this given when then format. There are similar other tools like this, so it's not the only tool which came up with this idea. And it's also open source. And actually what we share in SpecFlow with Cucumber is the Gherkin language, the language in which you can define these scenarios. It only defines a very few number of keywords which you can use to describe your scenarios. The actual description of your examples is done in the business language, so in the language of the business. So this is free text. Just these few keywords are given by the Gherkin parser. There are things like you can hook events and so on, which is not so interesting like right now. What is very interesting is that this is available in different human languages. So if your business speaks German, you can these keywords are available in German, and you can write scenarios in German. If your business speaks Swedish, you can write it in Swedish. So that the goal was to have some no impedance mismatch between the development team and the business. And this is how such an example looks like in Gherkin. So we have features. Features are user stories, basically. This is any kind of text, any free text, which describes the user story. This is where we hook into the requirement stream above the acceptance criteria. And the acceptance criteria actually calls scenarios here. And you see the given, when, and then steps. And each of these lines is basically then hooking into some automation piece to the application. And steps can have parameters. They can be tables or strings. Whatever you will see. I will show you in a second also this in code in Visual Studio. How does it work behind or under the curtain or behind the curtain? So how does SpecFlow automate these text files? So the feature files you saw are these scenarios, are this text describing the examples. And what you also have to do, you have to write step definitions. So for each line, for each part of the example, for each given, for each when, for each then, you have to write a definition, a regular expression which matches this. And with this regular expression, you basically write a piece of automation code which later on runs your application. And these feature files are then generated when you save the feature files in Visual Studio to some unit test fixture, where each scenario, each acceptance criteria is basically translated into a test method. And the test method then calls dynamically, according to what was written in the scenario, the different steps which you have just which you have bound. And this is how the automation works. Okay. It becomes a little bit more clear probably if I show you this in reality. So this is a sample application which comes with SpecFlow. So if you want to try this out afterwards, you can download this directly from the SpecFlow website. And this is a simple bookshop. So I just show it to you quickly that you see that this is a simple web application. It's having some search interface. You can search a catalog of books. And you can put a book to a shopping cart. and basically this is it. So it's quite a simple app, and this is what the sample is about. This sample is built with a MVC controller, so the ASP.NET MVC MVC pattern, MVC 2 actually. And I don't want to actually go into the application, but what I want to show you is there is a second project here in the solution, which is called acceptance tests, and this is where we have basically placed these examples, which are automating the acceptance criteria specified for this application. And for each user story, for each feature, we have a feature file where you basically see the feature described. This is, again, the user story here, which is the free text, so this is not interpreted in any way by the parser. And then you have, for each acceptance criteria, the scenario keyboard, and you have a name for the scenario, a name for the acceptance criteria. This would match to the abstract description of the acceptance criteria. And then you have the given, when, and then. Here the given is extracted into some background. I will explain this in a second. But basically you have a given again, the when, and the then. So these are basically how these scenarios are automated. I will show you how this runs first. So basically each of these scenarios is then run. In this case it's automated with MS test. You can also use NUnit or other unit testing runners. And just to make it a little bit more exciting, I will break one of the scenarios. So I will say another book should be, so this is the search. Title of the book should be matched, and I will search for a book domain. I have to list these kind of books here in my scenario, and I will change the name of the book here so that this test doesn't run anymore. And you could imagine that this could be also some violating acceptance criteria, or something has changed in a later iteration in some place of the application so that a certain acceptance criteria is not given anymore. And at this point, you see this failed test here. And you also see some details. So the developer can see, of course, the stack trace of the generated test. But the business or business analyst or anyone who wants to communicate sees also, again, the scenario. You see for each step whether the step has been executed successfully. And you see also what was the actual error here. So the developer could also say what was the actual error here. How does the technology behind it work? So as I said, for each of these feature files, the tool generates a unit test fixture. This is generated code. I just show it to you that you see how it works. You should never touch this actually. And for each scenario, so for each acceptance criteria, a method, a test method is generated. And in this test method, basically the scenario is run. So it's basically performing the call for each step here based on the text which was written in the scenario. And now how does the matching work? So how does, for example, I perform a simple search on a certain string work? These are the step definitions. This is also what you have to implement when you bind the scenario basically to your application. And here we have the step definitions. These are classes. We discuss later a little bit how you organize these classes. And basically for each step which you want to match in a scenario, you have to write a regular expression. This is how basically the test runner then tries to find the right step to execute. And you can also pass parameters here. So if I, for example, when I perform a simple search here, had a string parameter on what I want to search. And basically what you see here is how this is handed over as a parameter. And this is where we are actually now hooking into the automation. So this is where we call into the controller in this case, because we have an MVC application here. But this is where you could also automate through some other automation tools you want to use. So quite simple. There's also the possibility to have more complex parameters. You can have tables, as you have seen here. Then you get a table argument on your class, and you can parse the table and so on. So this is basically how it works. What is also interesting is that you can also debug the scenarios. So you can even set breakpoints here, because we generate this in the background in the unit test features. And if you debug your test, you can even step from the automated scenario step by step, and can basically see what your application does and see where the error is. You can even jump into the bindings if you want. So you can really use this as a live executable specification which describes what your system does. And in this case, I will get an exception here, because this is again the violation. All right. Good. So, let's stop this. This was a short demo of how this looks in practice. So how does this fit now into the workflows you are probably familiar with when you do test-driven development? So those people who showed hands when they said they use test-driven development already should be somehow familiar to them the way how this works. So in test-driven development, you basically write a failing unit test which describes the next expected aspect of your system to be fulfilled, of your unit. Then you implement what is necessary to fulfill this aspect, and then you refactor and go to the next aspect. So this is basically the cycle test-driven development does to drive the design of your application. Okay. Doing acceptance test-driven development or behavior-driven development is just extending this cycle to business. So now you are describing an example with your business, what aspect of a certain feature you want to see fulfilled, and you write a test, so these bindings should be done before you implement the feature, and you show that this is not fulfilled yet. Then you can fall back in your TDD cycle, and in the end, when your tests pass, you can go to the next aspect. So basically, it's just taking this cycle one step further. And what this should lead to is what is called outside-in development. And outside-in development doesn't necessarily mean that you go only from the top layer to the bottom layer, but what it means is that you actually develop features incrementally. So the idea of a user story to separate what is usually in a use case mixed in a lot of features. In user stories, you have isolated features. The idea of a user story that you can deliver features independently is taken one step further, and it says you basically work on one user story and there on one acceptance criteria and there on one unit at a time, and basically this is how you are organizing the flow of your development. And until you have implemented all acceptance criteria of one user story, you can go to the next user story. And this is how the flow should work. And what this leads to is that actually you only implement things that are actually necessary for the business, and only infrastructure which you actually need. And it should prevent you of developing layers which are probably used or probably not used in the future of your system. How do acceptance tests compare to unit tests? I guess it's quite clear already. With the acceptance tests, you basically they are basically written or understood by business. They should drive how your application evolves from the feature point of view, and should basically drive the features of your application. While unit tests are driving the design of your application and basically tell developers, Are there assumptions, their design assumptions still kept, and what are the next things they have to build into the application, into their architectural design? So there's a lot of developers here, I guess. I don't know anyone from the testers camp here. Okay, so what does it mean for testers now? is this the end of testing, or don't we need testing anymore? Actually, it's not right. It's actually the opposite. It's the beginning of a new life for testers, in my opinion. Because the point of acceptance criteria and automating them is that testers get rid of the stupid checks they have to do every time when an application is updated. And these checks, which they have to do all the time, are getting much more frequent when you do agile delivery. So if you don't deliver a system once in a year, but every 2 weeks, these kind of checks get quite a pain in the ass to do regularly. And the other thing is that not only that these checks are stupid to perform manually or to do by a tester, it's also not the primarily point of quality assurance to that we write these acceptance criteria and automate them, but this is the point of writing these, is to specify what business expects. And we don't do a full regression of all edge cases here, but we go as far as we need to understand what business expects. And if this understanding is here, we have enough examples. We don't write so many examples that we cannot come up with any more. It's like, if I try to explain you a concept, I also give you one or two examples and I don't give you 10 others, although I see you have understood it already. However, testing is much more than this. There is a lot of things which you cannot cover with this methodology and which is not verified with this. All this explorative testing, testing of whole workflows and scenarios are things which you still have to worry about, are things which you still have to do, but are things which you have much more time to do than if you would have to manually do all these checks as a tester. And as a tester, with this specification language you have, this kind of domain-specific language to describe your system behavior, you have something which you can use if you want to do further automation. So if you want to do some further tests, you can use this kind of language as well to write automation scripts for your application if it's suitable for the scenario you want to do. For explorative testing, probably not, right? Hard to do. Something which is probably worth to look at is the testing quadrant. So if you're a tester and you wonder how does this fit to testing, it was first described by Brian Merrick, and Lisa Crispin has written a very good book about agile testing, where she also talks about these testing quadrants. What she basically says is that there are two categories of testing. One is tests which are basically concerning business, and one is tests which are rather concerning technology. And there, on the other hand, there are things which are rather critical things, so tests which tell the team when they are wrong, and things on the left-hand side are things which are telling the team how they should do things before they do it wrong. And typically, unit tests, for example, are things which tell a developer how he wants to design or drive the design of his system, and they are quite technology-oriented. And traditionally, the testing otherwise is in the upper right quadrant, so business tests of the functionality and rather with the goal to issue bugs and not to tell upfront how the system should behave. What acceptance test-driven development and behavior-driven development is in is this quadrant. So it's still business-facing, so it's concerning business requirements, but it tells people upfront or the team upfront what they should build and not afterwards. So this was the point. We don't want to have the bugs. We want to have the acceptance criteria formalized enough to know what we should build. So that way you can also help as a tester, and this is also how the testers collaborate. So in these discussions, the testers have bring in a complete different perspective when it comes to specifying and not testing what a feature should do. But it's very helpful to have the testers also in this discussion. Now some work for the architects. What we found is that automating what looks nice in this demo, if you do it in a large project, there's a lot of questions you have to answer. And I just bring up the questions and some points how we do it, but we don't have final answers for this, and there are no one answer for this, but these are questions you always have to ask yourself when you try to do this in your project. One is, how do you structure all the vocabulary? How do you organize these bindings? You have seen just a few acceptance criteria. If you have a large project with a lot of user stories, with a lot of acceptance criteria, it's quite some effort to organize them, to find them right. There is some Visual Studio support already, which unfortunately doesn't run on my machine because it's quite shaky yet, to provide, especially with Visual Studio 2010, to provide syntax coloring and IntelliSense for the scenarios, and you can navigate between step bindings and between descriptions of the scenarios and the bindings. But still, there is a lot of things to do to organize these steps correctly. The second interesting question, which I will elaborate a little bit more, is on which layer you put the automation. So where do you want to automate? And how can you allow that the preconditions and the postconditions can be set up and checked efficiently? And another thing is that you develop a language with this domain language where you describe your acceptance criteria, and a lot of things, a lot of aspects you describe will be described in a similar way in another acceptance criteria. And it's quite an effort that you use the same terminology over the whole project. So once you call it like this and once you call a certain thing like that, if this becomes not if this is not unified, it can be very hard to understand and maintain these scenarios. And also how these bindings of these elements can be reused, so that you have to bind not every new feature from scratch, but that when you describe new features, you can use sentences or fragments of sentences which have been automated already. Then where do you want to execute your tests? You have to decide which unit testing framework you use. You can run this on a build server if you want. And these are all things which you should do iteratively. So you should try it out, see how it works, and have these questions in mind all of the time in your project, and not just make a big decision up front and then see what it brings. About mocking and stubbing and the backdoors. As you have seen, we have these three categories of steps, the preconditions, the automation of the feature, and then the assertions. The preconditions and the assertions are things which you can trick. So these are things you can directly, where you should provide backdoors in your automation, in the automation interfaces of your application, that you can set up the world for your acceptance criteria and check afterwards whether things have been fulfilled. So if you want to have a basket with a book, for example, then you don't want to drive through the ad book to basket feature this setup, but you rather want to somehow set this up in the background. However, the actual feature, this is where you should drive through all the layers of your application. This is where your acceptance test is actually running. This is what actually is utilizing the feature you want to test or the acceptance criteria you want to test. So this is where you must not trick. If you don't trick here, but also run this through all of your layers, then you will get brittle and hard to maintain tests. So you will not be able to keep these up to date until the end of your project. We have seen this. I've said that you drive the feature through all your layers. That's the second question you have to ask. Where do you automate? Is it really all the layers you want to automate? Because you have several choices. You could either go from the UI through all the way down to the database, or you could do it just below the UI, or you could do it even lower. Let's have a look at these different options. The automation through the UI is what probably many of you think about first when they see this and when they have done already automated testing in projects. The advantage of this is that you have a full end-to-end verification of your scenarios. So if you do this, the whole application with everything, with the UI, is verified according to a certain acceptance criteria. However, I would not recommend to do this, because if you do this, you will get a lot of additional complexity in your scripts, and it's very hard to maintain these bindings. And if I could choose to not automate an acceptance criteria and have the others automated through the UI, or rather have every single acceptance criteria automated but not go through the UI, I would always go through, have all acceptance criteria automated and do the UI check somehow else. So the goal is to have your specification executable, not to test the user interface. Another reason why the goal is not to test the user interface is that these examples you have seen are very, user interface details are very hard to express in such examples. How would you imagine the given when then description for user interface details like having the logo aligned with some table or having a certain box, certain control somewhere? This would be very awkward to write in text. So how would you do examples? Exactly, this is how you do it, with scribbles. These are good examples. This is another abstraction, and this is not, we cannot automate this with this tool. So you anyway have to deal with this somehow else. But that's another reason why I wouldn't automate through the whole UI, this acceptance criteria. So what we think is the best option to do it just below the UI, and there, as an architect, you have to either establish an architecture where this is easily possible, like using MVC or any other suitable architecture, or if you cannot do this, then you will have to do some work to give some API just below the UI for the automation. And you have to check the UI otherwise, which you anyway have to do. Another option, which I don't want to discuss too much, is automation through services. So of course, you encapsulate probably in your architecture some services, and yes, you could also automate service behavior like this. And if it's really a web service you're developing, and you're really just, your consumer is some web service user, so some other application which calls your web service, then it's fine to describe the scenarios like this. What we don't think is useful if you are having actually some user logic above your web services and you do the automation only on your web service layer below, because the gap between what is written in your scenario and what you have to then trick in your binding gets too big, and actually business cannot validate anymore whether what they actually assumed is given by your application. So if you just develop some web services, then this is an option where it would be interesting. Okay, as a summary, what are the key takeaways I want to give with this presentation? The first thing is that behavior-driven development is something which helps you bridging this communication gap between business and the development team. It helps the developers to drive their architecture and their features, so they know what to build next and what infrastructure they need to build a certain features. It can help the testers to build their test scenarios. The second thing, which is very important in my opinion, is that through automating these descriptions, the specification details are something which is as valuable as the code of your application. So it's not anymore a document or something which resides in some repository which becomes inconsistent and out of date with your application, but every time you run the build of your application, you know whether all of your specifications which you have given so far are still met. I've heard from systems where the specifications outlived the system which they were built for, because when the system was migrated to a newer technology, the specifications were kept. We haven't done this, so I had to believe that, but at least you see what the point is here. So the specification is more valuable almost than the code. And it's a first-class artifact in your project. It's not some paper or something which is inconsistent or not true anymore. And the third thing is that we showed this with SpecFlow. However, I will show in a second a few other tools. some books I want to mention for this topic. Of course, everything with requirements engineering is interesting in this area. I still like Coburn, although I don't like use cases anymore. Everything with test-driven development, there is some good book from Lisa Crispin I mentioned about agile testing. Goiko Acic wrote a quite good book about these communication issues between the different stakeholders in projects. So all these books give you a quite good overview about this topic. Tools. We showed SpecFlow for .NET. We were just basically blandly copying the idea from Cucumber, so we are, I wouldn't say we are the inventors, we picked this up and tried to make it run on the .NET platform. There are other tools which go into the same direction. They don't necessarily use exactly the same concept, but they use the concept of communicating through examples and driving the application, what it should deliver through examples. But please remember, the interesting or the important part is that you don't pick the tool and do what the tool tells you, but you understand what this is about and then find the right tool to suit your needs. All right, then, questions? In what sense? Yeah, well, you can maintain the feature files in your. So the SpecFlow provides a Visual Studio project type, and you can check in, check out feature files in Team Foundation Server. So yes, that works. Any other questions? All right. Yes, it was, I would say, the first project which was bigger where we used it was about 50 user stories, probably 50, 60, and probably 500 acceptance criteria in total, 600, and it was a few hundred days work. In the first project, it was quite a lot of work because we fell into a lot of traps. So one of the problems we had in the first project was that the abstraction level on which we described the acceptance criteria was too low. So we basically ended up with acceptance criteria descriptions, which were basically where you could configure a database. So you could the tester could write a text file where he where he modifies the database because it was much too low abstraction. At this point, we had five developers and one and a half person just keeping the specs and the bindings up to date. So this was the ratio between developers and specs. I would say it's hard to say because we don't want to separate it anymore. So actually, what we also did wrong there is that there was dedicated person doing the bindings. And now what we want to do is that actually the developer who is implementing the feature is actually doing the automation of the feature first. Any other questions? Actually, the binding code itself is hand-coded. So you can, of course, if you would automate through the UI, you would probably record some scripts and then take the recorded scripts and put it in there. But actually, it's hand-coded. It's like if you write a unit test. Yeah. Yes. Okay, yeah, you don't write unit tests for your automation code anymore, yeah. But by showing to business whether certain, so of course, if you find an error in an acceptance criteria, it can be that the automation, the binding is wrong. Yes, so that's why it's not generated. It's something you have to By the way, Gojko Arcic, who wrote the book Bridging the Communication Gap, he's writing on a book right now where he is trying to gather statistics and about projects running after this methodology. So I expect that there is a broader overview about experiences with that in also larger projects available. It should come out during this year. Other questions? All right. Almost on time. Yeah.